This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 20. 2 Samuel chapter 20, and let me review just briefly while you're turning there the events in the life of David, which we covered in our last lecture. Absalom, David's son, had led an attempted coup d'etat. He gathered many men to fight against David and his loyalists. You recall also that Absalom had appointed his cousin, Amasa, as his top general. Now, if you still have the chart of David's family, which we sent out last time and several weeks before that, this one here, you'll see that Amasa is also then cousin to David's top general Joab and Joab's brother Abishai. David's close counselor Ahithophel had betrayed him, and when it became apparent that the revolt was going to fail, Ahithophel went out and hanged himself, becoming the type for which Judas is the antitype. As David's men routed Absalom's forces, you'll recall that Absalom was riding his mule, and Absalom somehow got his head entangled between the branches of a big old oak tree. And our dear friend Ron Oja gave us some additional course material on the relationship of the oak tree and idolatry and witchcraft in the church. As David came back to Jerusalem, we saw how the various tribes either welcomed him back or were reluctant to do so, with pretty good reason. They were afraid that David would have them all killed for treason, for supporting Absalom. But we saw in David's forgiveness of everyone that it was a type and shadow of the Father's ultimate universal reconciliation. David is now back in his palace at Jerusalem, and he's hardly had time to take a shower before he faces another rebellion. 2 Samuel 20, verse 1. And there happened to be there a man of Belial, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." This rebel, it says, was a son of Bichri. In Genesis 46, 21, you don't need to turn there, the sons of Benjamin are listed, and one of them is Becher, or Becher, B-E-C-H-E-R, from which you get the word Bichri, B-I-C-H-R-I. It so happens that King Saul was also, most likely, of this particular clan, the Bichrites of Benjamin. Apparently, there was still much bitterness and resentment among this clan of the Benjamites over the fact that the monarchy of all Israel was now in the tribe of Judah. Was it God's plan for Saul the Benjamite to fail and for the dynasty of kings to come from the tribe of Judah? Was that in God's plan? Yes, indeed. So in rebelling against King David, was Sheba the Bichrite actually rebelling against God? What do you think? Yes. Yes, indeed. We will rejoin this idea of rebelling against God before we finish our two-part message today. And incidentally, we're entitling this lecture, at least I think so right now. I might change my mind before I put the labels on the tapes, but I think I'll call it, "Should We Come Out of Babylon?" Verse 2. So every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah clave unto their king from Jordan even to Jerusalem. And David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in ward and fed them, but went not in unto them. So they were shut up unto the day of their death, living in widowhood. Recall that when Absalom had put his plan into motion, to dethrone David, his father, that he followed Ahithophel's advice and raped these women on the rooftop of David's palace to publicly humiliate David, not to mention humiliating the women themselves. When David returned, he did not divorce them, since they were not the victims, they were not at fault. But since he viewed them as contaminated, he never again had relations with them. Now, please understand, he did not treat them cruelly as though they were kept in prison, which is the impression one might get from the phrase, he put them in ward. Doesn't really mean that they were put in prison. Rather, they were kept in a separate house, probably quite nicely appointed, and they were well cared for until their deaths. This was the customary manner in which the widows of Oriental monarchs were treated in those days. Verse 4. Then said the king to Amasa. Now remember, Amasa was the top general of the rebel Absalom. And David had forgiven Amasa. And he says to him, assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present. Again, if you look on that family tree chart, you'll find Amasa in the upper left corner of the chart, and it shows that Amasa was the nephew of David and the cousin of Absalom. Of course, that would make him a cousin of General Joab and Abishai as well. David is probably still seething at Joab for having murdered his son Absalom, and he's determined to replace Joab as head of the armies of Israel. This new rebellion by Sheba provides David the opportunity to make public his promise to Amasa. So he charges him with recruiting an army from Judah and to come back to the palace with the troops within 3 days so he can get further orders. 5. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which he had appointed him. Now, we don't know for certain what the problem was here, whether the Judahites were reluctant to follow this man who had so recently been the top general in the rebellion, in the attempted coup d'etat. That's certainly one possibility. The other possibility is that Amasa himself may have dawdled because he was having second thoughts about serving David loyally. In any case, he did not report back to the palace with the recruits by the time appointed. David's probably pacing back and forth when the time is up and he's wondering where this guy is. And he realizes that every day that goes by in putting down the rebellion gives Sheba that much more time to garner more rebels to his cause. And so David turned to Abishai, Joab's brother, to take the palace guard and some other troops and go forth after the rebels. Now this must have been pretty awkward for David and also embarrassing for him in front of Joab, because the man he had just appointed to replace Joab, Amasa, evidently couldn't do the job. He was a no-show. So, being in a pickle, in a dilemma, David turns to Joab's brother. Well, you can imagine how offended and silently enraged the callous and haughty old general Joab is now as his brother is appointed to head the mission. Verse 6. And David said to Abishai, now shall Sheba, the son of Bichri, do us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy lord's servants and pursue after him, lest he get him fenced cities and escape us. And there went out after him Joab's men, and the Kerethites, and the Pelethites, and all the mighty men, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa went before them. Margin says that he caught up with them there at Gibeon. Now let's pause for a moment and locate Gibeon for you. This, you can see the map here. You got the territory of Judah down here. There's Jerusalem. Here's the territory of Benjamin. And there's the city of Gibeon right there, which is about 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem. It was an important city. It was the hometown of the Canaanite Amorite tribe of the Hivites, who had deceived Joshua into thinking that they were from a distant land so that he wouldn't slay them as Israel came into Canaan land. And this is going to be part of our study later today. When Joshua divided up the land, Gibeon was allotted as part of the territory of Benjamin. But then a little bit later, it was designated as one of the 48 cities given to the Levites. It was also one of the several places where the tabernacle of the wilderness had been placed. David took the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem and built a separate three-sided tent called a tabernacle in Jerusalem. But the rest of the tabernacle itself, the one they'd carried around in the wilderness for 40 years, apparently remained at Gibeon. This fact would also give David justification for having the two co-high priests, Abiathar and Zadok, one to minister at Gibeon and the other to minister at the tabernacle of David in Jerusalem. Well, later still, Gibeon was the place where God appeared to King Solomon in a dream and bestowed the great wisdom upon him. And so, as the text states, Gibeon is where the respective armies of Amasa and Abishai met up with each other. Verse 8, second half. And Joab's garment that he had put on was girded unto him, and upon it a girdle with a sword fastened upon his loins in the sheath thereof, and as he went forth, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, remember, they're cousins, he says, art thou in health, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with the right hand to kiss him. But Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's hand, so he smote him therewith in the fifth rib and shed out his bowels to the ground and struck him not again, and he died. So Joab and Abishai his brother pursued after Sheba the son of Bichri. We'll stop there. The fact that Amasa died and that Joab and Abishai pursued after Sheba are summary statements. Let's go back now and follow this crime step by step. After David had appointed Abishai to head up the army to pursue the rebels, Joab probably pretended to be content just to fall in line behind his brother. They come to the place of the great stone at Gibeon, where Amasa and his troops catch up. You can just picture this. Joab smiles his treacherous and deceitful smile at Amasa as he sees him, and he's walking over to greet him, and oh, how embarrassing for the great general Joab to be so clumsy as to have his sword accidentally fall out of its scabbard. Or was it an accident? Well, Joab picks up his short sword with his left hand just as he's getting in front of Amasa to grab him by the beard, which is the way they close friends greeted each other in those days. They take the right hand, grab each other's beard, pull each other close, and kiss each other on the beard. Well, he's smiling, he's picking up the sword, and you know, because it had just clunked out, and of course Amasa is not thinking anything of it, and as soon as he grabs him by the beard, pulls him close, rams that sword right under the fifth rib. Now, we've come across that fifth rib term in a number of places in the scripture, and what I've found out is, well, that's the place where all the vital organs are, not all the vital organs, but if you stab under the fifth rib, you're going to hit the liver and lots of other vital organs, and you know, a short sword is still pretty long, can go right through you. And so he takes that sword, shoves it in, into the liver, and twists and turns and slices and dices it, pretty crude, and, you know, pulls, and out comes all his innards, we would say. And so Joab's holding Amasa by the beard as he does this, and of course as he loses his strength, he lowers him to the ground and lets him lay there. As verse 11, one of Joab's men stood by and said, he that favoreth Joab and he that is for David, let him go after Joab. Well, this verse indicates that the rivalry between Joab and Amasa was no secret. It was common knowledge that David had intended to demote Joab and to place Amasa as his top general. Therefore, Joab's motive for murdering Amasa was his jealousy. But more so, it was Joab's covetousness for power and prestige. He was not going to let that little pipsqueak David get away with demoting him. It was humiliating. Joab's pride could not stand it. Thus, he murdered his cousin in cold blood, just as he had murdered General Abner and Absalom before them. Well, immediately after Joab had slid the sword under Amasa's fifth rib, one of Joab's men yells out to the soldiers, whoever's on Joab's and David's side, let him come with Joab. Notice how in that verse he's linking Joab with David, implying or insinuating that Amasa was not loyal to David. Now, the insinuation may have been already stated clearly to the soldiers with Abishai as they were leaving Jerusalem, because Abishai could have very slyly spread the rumor that Amasa was disloyal because he didn't come back to Jerusalem with an army within 3 days, as David had instructed. And I would not put it past Joab to have instructed his man in advance here on what to say and when to say it, so that the recruits that Amasa had brought to Gibeon are just standing there, shocked at seeing their leader on the ground. 12. And Amasa wallowed in blood in the midst of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa out of the highway into the field and cast the cloth upon him, when he saw that every one of them that came by him stood still. And when he was removed out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue after Sheba the son of Bichri. You can imagine that the contingent of men whom Amasa had recruited from Judah were stunned at having just witnessed this cold-blooded murder. They were paralyzed. They just stood there, unable to think clearly, until Joab's henchmen threw a sheet over poor Amasa, still writhing in torturous pain. And only when Joab's henchmen dragged him off the highway out into the field, only then could the men kind of mentally snap out of it and shake off what they'd just witnessed. And so, like a flock of sheep, they fall in ranks behind Joab. Verse 14. And he, I think that refers to Sheba, the son of Bichri, went through all the tribes of Israel unto Abel to Beth-Maacah. So they were here, I say they, meaning Joab and Abishai and the troops. Meanwhile, this rebel, Sheba, had been going through all the tribes of Israel. In other words, he's working his way north like this and going up to the furthest extremity of the territory or of the country of Israel. It says, and they were gathered together and went also after him. They, meaning Joab, Abishai, and all the troops, went after Sheba. So Sheba was able to gather more and more men, perhaps, to his rebellious cause as he journeyed northward in Israel. Until they came to the very northern border, to that place called Abel of Beth-Maacah. This Abel, by the way, is a different Hebrew word from the name of the brother of Cain. Abel, Cain's brother, his name means vapor or breath. And the word Abel here, different Hebrew word, means a grassy meadow. Verse 15. And they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth-Maacah, and they cast up a bank against the city. I guess it was Citibank, right? And it stood in the trench, and all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. This compound word Beth-Maacah is intriguing. By now, many of us recognize the Hebrew word Beth, as in Bethlehem. What does Beth mean? House, right. Now, Beth-Maacah means house of pressure or oppression. From your chart, again, of David's family tree, you might notice that Maacah was the name of one of David's wives. Which one? She was the mother of Absalom, the rebel, and Adonijah, who's going to pull an Absalom in the next couple chapters here. The two rebel sons. Well, given all the sad events which occurred in the family of David, do you think it is fair to say that David lived in a house of pressure? Indeed. And his household was perhaps oppressed by the evil spirits which had snared Absalom and Amnon, who'd raped his sister Tamar, and also Adonijah, like I said, who's going to pull an Absalom here before too long. Do you think David lived in a Beth-Maacah, a house of oppression? If I were a gambling man, I would bet that many of us can identify with a Beth-Maacah. Certainly with our extended families, if not with our own nuclear family. Am I right? Do sometimes some of you feel like you're living in a pressure cooker? House of pressure? Well, Joab leads his troops to this far northern city and begins the siege, when suddenly a woman from the city grabs a megaphone or a bullhorn, whatever you want to call it, and yells at Joab. 16. Then cried a wise woman out of the city, Hear, hear, say, I pray you unto Joab, come near hither that I may speak with thee. And when he was come near unto her, the woman said, Art thou Joab? And he answered, I am he. Then she said unto him, Hear the words of thine handmaid. And he answered, I do hear. Then she spake, saying, They were wont to speak in old times, saying, They shall surely ask counsel at Abel. And so they ended the matter. That last verse is a little bit unclear, so I'm going to give you the New King James Version translation. So she spoke, saying, They used to talk in former times, saying, They shall surely seek guidance at Abel. And so they would end their disputes. In other words, the city of Abel was a place that was noted for the wisdom of its inhabitants. And so this is one of the reasons that this woman gives to Joab as to why he should sit down and talk with her about the situation. She continues, verse 19, I am one of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Thou seekest to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. How appropriate, Mother's Day, huh? Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of Yahweh? So this wise woman is speaking as one representing the city. And when she speaks, she's speaking metaphorically here, I believe, because when she says, I am peaceable and faithful, she's referring to her city of Abel. It was so far north, it probably had no part in the rebellion of Absalom. It's a peaceful city. And when she charges Joab with seeking to destroy, quote, a city and a mother in Israel, she's again referring to the city of Abel as a type of regional capital. It was a mother city, because it was a city which was surrounded by a bunch of lesser villages and towns that all depended on the central hub city for their support. At the same time, and although it's not overtly stated here, I believe the woman also reminded Joab of the laws of warfare, which are found in Deuteronomy 20. One of those laws was that before an army could besiege a city, they had to first do what? Does anybody know? Proclaim peace to that city. That meant they had to exhaust all the diplomatic measures first. So this wise woman is telling Joab that even heathen cities are accorded this opportunity to avoid mass bloodshed. How much more, then, ought the same opportunity be given to a city in Israel? She finally persuaded Joab there might be some way that they could work things out without resorting to the slaughter of every person in Abel. Joab, probably a bit ashamed, is then quick to accommodate the woman. Verse 20. And Joab answered and said, Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. The matter is not so. Now pause there a second. Joab is saying, look, that really isn't the case. We're not coming to conquer your city just so we can steal your inheritance. The real situation is this. Verse 21, last half. But a man of Mount Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, hath lifted up his hand against the king, even against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said unto Joab, Behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. Well, it seems self-evident that this woman held considerable influence in the city to be able to make a promise like that, don't you think? Then the woman went unto all the people in her wisdom, or with her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and cast it out to Joab. Look out below! And he blew a trumpet, and they retired from the city, every man to his tent, and Joab returned to Jerusalem unto the king. Okay, what just happened here? A city in Israel turned over to the government troops a man who was a rebel against the government. According to the government. Remember the city of Keilah? This is when David was hiding from Saul, and when David inquired of the Lord. Let me read a few of those verses just to refresh your memories. It's back in 1 Samuel 23:8. You won't need to turn there, just going to read a couple. And Saul called all the people together to go to war, to go down to Keilah, to besiege David and his men. And David knew that Saul secretly practiced mischief against him, and so he said to Abiathar the priest, Bring hither the ephod. Then said David, O Yahweh, God of Israel, thy servant hath certainly heard that Saul seeketh to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. You see the parallels here? Joab came to Abel to destroy that city because they wanted to get that rebel. Verse 11, Will the men of Keilah deliver me up into his hand? Will Saul come down as thy servant hath heard? O Yahweh, God of Israel, I beseech thee, tell thy servant. And Yahweh said, he will come down. Then said David, will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? And Yahweh said, they will deliver thee up. Perfect parallel, isn't it? In view of what you're going to hear towards the end of this message today, what's important for us to realize is that David was not in rebellion against the government of Saul. It was a wicked government, but David, as an overcomer type, was not in rebellion, was he? Saul said he was, but was he? No. Remember that. After Sheba the Benjamite's head had been turned over to Joab by the good citizens of Abel Beth-Maacah, Joab then went back to Jerusalem and reported to King David. And what could David do? Amasa, the general he had sent out, was dead. No doubt Joab informed David that Amasa was a traitor anyhow and deserved to die. Joab went on to recount how he had successfully resolved the rebellion of Sheba. And I get the feeling that Joab could have been so brazen by this time that he didn't ask David, he told David that he was taking his old job back again. He had already assumed command of the armies. Abishai, his brother, had obviously acquiesced to playing second fiddle. What could David say? The pattern of the relationship between David and Joab had been deeply ingrained for decades now. David felt helpless to change it. So the scriptures next give us a listing of the names of the high officials in David's second administration, we could call it. Verse 23, now Joab was over all the hosts, or the armies, of Israel. To the end of his life, David was unable to control Joab, and so he acquiesced to Joab's fait accompli. The listing goes on. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and over the Pelethites. These groups, you'll recall, were the Philistines. Yes, they were Philistines who had been loyal to David for decades. They were his Praetorian Guard, his secret service detachment. Verse 24, and Adoram was over the tribute. This is the shortened form of his name. The long form is Adoniram. He was secretary of the treasury, which took in the tribute money from all the foreign nations which had been subdued by David. And Adoniram's responsibilities likely also included the ancient equivalent of the IRS. 24b. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. This was a highly important post. His job was to chronicle the events of the reign of the king. And the recorder was also used as a vizier. Joseph was the vizier of Egypt. In other words, and also as an ambassador at large, truly an important functionary in the court. 25, and Sheba was scribe. Back in chapter 8, we had been given the list of David's cabinet in his first administration. There the scribe was Seraiah. This is the same man, Sheba, same name, just a different, another name, another form of his name. In fact, David's second term cabinet officials were almost identical to the first. Continuing verse 25, and Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. And so we find once again the names of Zadok and Abiathar, noting as usual that Zadok of the Aaronic priestly line of Eleazar is listed first. Verse 26, and Ira, also the Jairite, was a chief ruler about David. This is different though. Back in chapter 8, it had said that David's sons were the chief rulers. Obviously, most of the sons of David did not turn out to be good apples, did they? Now, here's a short verse where the King James Version translators ran into a bit of theological difficulty. And so they covered up the embarrassment by mistranslating the Hebrew word Kohen, which is pronounced Cohen in English, C-O-H-E-N. You've seen that name? It simply and only means priest. It's translated correctly by the word priest about 750 times in the Hebrew Old Testament. But twice, the King James Version translators used the term chief ruler. You see, this Ira fellow was from the tribe of Manasseh, but the priests could only come from the tribe of Levi. And hence the translators, not knowing what to do, didn't translate it as priest. They said chief ruler.
There is, of course, the possibility that David used this Ira fellow as a chief ruler or high official of some sort or the other, but that then begs the question, well, why didn't the Holy Spirit inspire the human author to use some other Hebrew word which means exactly that, chief ruler? There are plenty of words in Hebrew to choose from. If Ira was not a priest, why call him a Kohen, a Cohen? I don't know the solution to that dilemma, so if you here or anyone on the tape ministry does, please share it with me. Well, that concludes chapter 20, and since we're going to need more time for the next chapter, we're not going to take a break just yet, but we're going to continue right on into the next chapter. 2 Samuel 21, verse 1. Then there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of Yahweh, and Yahweh answered, "It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites." If you've been with us here for some length of time, or if you've been on our tape ministry since the very beginning, you'll know that we've made reference to this story before, but I don't think we've ever taken it apart and scrutinized it verse by verse, as we intend to do presently. Well, as I promised some minutes ago, Gibeon, this city right here in Benjamin, 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem, Gibeon is prominent in the rest of our study today. The first thing we want to note, though, is the chronology. It's unfortunate that the King James translators used the word "then" to introduce this story, because in our modern understanding, it indicates that what follows occurs after what we just read, and this is not the case here. It's almost universally agreed upon by Bible scholars that this event that we're going to read occurred not near the end of David's reign and of his life, because the two were almost simultaneous, but rather, it happened not too long after David had been made king over all of Israel. Even at that, it would have been some 7 or more years after the death of King Saul, because you remember that when David first became king, for the first 7.5 years, it was only over Judah, wasn't it? And so in his 40-year reign, 7.5 years, it was just over Judah, and then the other 33.5 years, he reigned over all 12 tribes. So what I'm saying is, it was probably at least 7.5 or 8 or more years into the reign before this event happened. He is clearly king over Benjamin and all of Israel as this happened. And the reasons why we believe this story occurred early in David's reign are numerous, and some will be noted as we proceed. From this very first verse, however, there are 3 reasons. One, we've mentioned a number of times in past lectures about the very compact nature of the Hebrew language. That means that just one word in Hebrew often carries an entire phrase worth of meaning, if you will, in English. In one verse here, the English translation says, quote, "Then there was a famine," end quote. But in Hebrew, the only word in the actual text is ra'ab, the word for famine. The words "then there was a" are what we call elliptical. That means they're understood in Hebrew without being stated. Give you a modern example. You've seen billboards that say, "Got milk?" How many of you have seen those advertisements? That's a very elliptical question. If we were to flesh it out with all the elliptical words added in, instead of "got milk," we would say, "Do you have any milk?" But everybody understands in America when it says "got milk," everybody knows what that means. But yet, it's not quote-unquote good English. If we were to flesh it out, we would say, "Have you got any milk?" or "Do you have any milk?" And so that's what elliptical means. Now in Hebrew, their whole language is like that. It was all compressed and compact, so that one word implied a whole bunch of other things. And you can see some of the problems this gives the translators. Not only that, but the wide latitude of meaning available for them to choose from. Now there is an actual word for "then" in Hebrew, but it's not in the Hebrew text here. Therefore, when the Revised Version uses "and" instead of "then," it's just as correct. And in this case, even more so, because it does not imply that the story we're about to read occurred after the one we just finished reading. So in general, then, can you see how someone who wants to use only his English translation and build a doctrine around certain words is skating on thin theological ice? Now, this is not to discourage us in any way such that we would think that we all have to be Hebrew scholars. Not at all. After all, these are not matters that your salvation depends upon. They're minutiae for those of us who are interested in the details. And as you know, when it comes to God's Word, I'm one of those persons, and I'm delighted to know that you are as well. The second reason we're not forced, to place this story at the end of David's life is that verse 1 gives us merely a general statement that it occurred, quote, in the days of David, end quote. Frankly, it would have been perfectly understandable if the translators had left the word then out altogether. The third reason is that if the famine had occurred later in David's reign, which was after David had conquered many other nations, then a famine in Israel could have been alleviated by the importation of sufficient food from those subjugated nations in the form of tribute. Do you have the Farrar Fenton there? What does it say for that? Then there was a famine.
There was once a famine in the time of David.
Okay. There was once a famine. You see, that doesn't imply that it's happening right now. It could have been any time. That's a better translation. Before we continue with this story, jump down to verse 15, where it says, "Moreover, the Philistines had yet war again with Israel, and David went down, and his servants with him, and fought against the Philistines, and David waxed faint." The same chronological situation exists here. This war with the Philistines did not occur late in David's reign, and I can see that it says here that David waxed or grew faint, and so you might think, well, doesn't that indicate he was getting old? Well, David died at age 70, and if he were pushing 70, sure, he would be getting faint in battle, especially when you read the rest of those verses and you find out it's Goliath's brothers that they're doing battle with. But I have to tell you, you don't have to be 70 to realize that you don't have the physical stamina anymore like you did when you were 25. After only 13 years as king over all Israel, David would have been about 50 years old. And I can assure you, I love basketball, but I can't take full court games like I could when I was 25. That's the truth. How many of you agree with me? How many of you know that? Okay. So.
But now you play smarter, not smarter.
Play smarter, yeah, I think. Other than that, since we won't have time, I won't go into all the reasons why this battle occurred much earlier, say when David was 50 or so, but then the text goes on to talk about how Goliath's brothers were sent to, let's just say, they were sent to Hell's Gate by David's elite warriors. And we've discussed that in a message not too long ago, so you can reread these verses later if you wish. All right, back to the beginning of the story. So far, the facts are that after three successive years of famine, David goes to God and inquires, why? Notice the connection between a disaster, in this case, a natural disaster, a weather disaster. It was a connection between that as the effect and God as the cause, and it was assumed. In those days, no one questioned the connection between natural disaster or other types of disasters and God being the cause of it. Wasn't Satan? No. Well, I don't see Satan's name in there anywhere. But my, how far we have come. Thank God we live in the 21st century and we've been able to shed those naive superstitions, right? As though God controlled the weather.
Only 89 tornadoes last week.
Right. We've made some real intellectual progress, haven't we? Not hardly. Instead, we suffer more and more disasters and we wonder why. We blame it on bad luck. Blame it on coincidence. We blame it on bad guys using the harp technology. But God forbid that we should give God the credit for his disciplinary disasters. Turn to Amos chapter 4. And glad you brought that up, Arden. Because do you get the impression from the news lately, in fact this week, that our weather patterns are becoming more and more erratic and severe? It's a fact. Just this past week, when tornadoes devastated many places in the nation's midsection, I heard one national weather expert declare that while having tornadoes is a normal part of annual weather patterns, that having so many of them, along with very high damaging winds and hail the size of grapefruit, I heard happened yesterday in Iowa, and so large a portion of the country at the same time being affected, that is what is unheard of. Unprecedented. And the ferocity of the weather is getting worse and worse. This past week, Kansas, Missouri, Tennessee, the extreme weather was indeed a blow to the nation's midsection. It's as though it was a punch in the stomach from God. And poor Oklahoma City. who had 44 people killed just 4 years ago, almost to the day, by a F5 tornado with the winds that were, I mean, that's the most severe there's ever been, 318 miles per hour, if I recall, F5. And you folks, you're from near Oklahoma City, aren't you? You remember that 4 years ago, the F5 tornado? And now they've been hit along virtually the same path. Our people need to realize what David understood, that our Creator is in charge of all the weather, even when men actually do manipulate it with high technology. We need to reread parts of our Bible, parts which we've perhaps not read in years, and let it sink in again. In Amos 4, God takes credit for the disasters. Verse 6 in Amos 4. And I also have given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and want or lack of bread in all your places. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. Well, they had clean teeth, my friends, not because they brushed after every meal, but because they didn't have any meals. It was a famine. They had no food in their mouths. That's why they had clean teeth. Yet ye have not returned unto me. That's the refrain here. All these things happen to force God's people to return to Him. Verse 7. And also I have withheld the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to harvest. And I caused it to rain upon one city and caused it not to rain upon another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. We've had 5 years of drought in parts of the southeast, including Asheville. Now we've had so much rain in Asheville in the past month that flash floods are a daily warning. It went from one extreme to the other. And the other day, there was worse rain and severe flooding in parts of northern Alabama than they've ever had since they began keeping records 150 years ago. And I believe it was almost exactly 10 years ago, 1993, when there was horrendous flooding in the nation's midsection, up and down the Mississippi and the Missouri rivers and their tributaries. And we did a series of tapes at that time on the curses of Deuteronomy 28. And one of those pairs of messages was called Floods of Judgment. Those are still available, listed on our order form, and they are still pertinent because Deuteronomy 28 did not expire at the cross. Verse 8, so two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied. Yet ye have not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. I have smitten you with blasting. In other words, high winds, tornadoes, and hurricanes, with blasting and mildew, when your gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees increased, the palmer worm devoured them. Yet ye have not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. I have sent among you the pestilence after the manner of Egypt. Those are cattle diseases. Anybody heard of mad cow disease? Yeah. Hello? Your young men have I slain with the sword, and have taken away your horses, and I have made the stink of your camps to come up into your nostrils. Yet have ye not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. I have overthrown some of you as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and ye were as a firebrand plucked out of the burning. Yet ye have not returned unto me, saith Yahweh. Therefore thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. It seemed that the national news last week focused most often on a town in Missouri, or as they say, Missouri, called Pierce City, which was virtually destroyed by killer tornadoes. The whole town looked like parts of Baghdad after it was struck by the U.S. precision-guided bombs last month. Pierce City, God was piercing the nation in our midsection, trying to get our attention so that we will return unto Him. What is it going to take?